Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the last of this term's seminars, research seminars in the Hellenic Observatory. We're going to make a start, and hopefully some more people will filter in as they finish with other commitments. It gives me immense pleasure this evening to welcome two personal friends and friends of the Observatory, Professor Antigone Liberaki and Dr. Platontinos, who have both been fellows, senior fellows here at the Observatory in the last year, and they're always welcome back, as they know, to participate in our events and present their very interesting work to our seminars. I'm not going to spend too long introducing them both, because I'm sure they're both very familiar to both of you. Antigone is a professor of economics at Pandya University. More importantly, she has been recently a visiting professor at the Hellenic Observatory, and also she served as an MP for the Potami between January and September 2015. She has worked on a number of other public issues, both professionally and personally, and she specializes on works on migration, feminist economics, family business, labor market, etc., etc. She is an economist with a variety of different weapons to her armory, if I could use that analogy. Dr. Platontinos is a professor at the University of Piraeus. He too has been a visitor at the Hellenic Observatory very recently. He too has had a public life, and he served as a special advisor to the Prime Minister of Greece between 96 and 2004, specializing in social policy and pensions. We welcome them both to this evening's seminar, where they're going to be speaking on a work which was sponsored by the National Bank of Greece through the Hellenic Observatory. And the title of tonight's talk is Advance or Regression, Gender Balance and the Crisis in Greece. I don't know who's speaking first.
Well, we could actually speak together, but it's probably just as well because we need a conductor now. The subtitle we changed to Gender Risk Assessment because we really don't know what the effect of the crisis is or will be in gender, which is probably one of the interesting things about the Greek crisis, that it's uniquely deep, it's uniquely long, and it has already sort of metastasized twice. So it started off as a private sector crisis in 2010-2012, pretty similar to the sort of crisis that they had in Europe immediately after the financial crunch in 2007. Then it shifted to a public sector austerity crisis between 2012 and 2005, and now it's more of a sort of service finance sector crisis, including all the other things. So it's really much more complex than the usual austerity narrative. And it also, interestingly, because it's actually very long, you cannot avoid the long-term secular changes which are taking place at the same time. So there's aging, technology, and globalization, and the changes in the world of work, things taking place. And it also is interesting because it's taking place in a country which has been following the acquis, the community acquis on gender, which is very active since the 1981, so already. So if it should have been buttressed against change. Now, a crisis which is so deep and long can actually be used to test ideas about how the sort of things that social anthropologists are interested in, and I see two or three made the mistake to come to this to listen to us. The sort of things that they're interested in are usually treated separately from economics because they tend to evolve with a different time frame. Now, the things that we have a crisis which is very long and deep, and it's the sort of crisis that you would expect to be reflected in a change of mind frame. So this is really the key driver, as we'll see further on. So the story of this research. Now, the National Bank of Greece, again, in a hopeful way, and everybody else was very hopeful at the time, thought the crisis was going to be over in December 2014. Now, and hence decided to award this research grant to celebrate the exit, in a way. And they were unfortunately proven completely wrong. And the crisis is still going strong. The research project, which was supposed to track what happened during the crisis, had to actually track the crisis itself. And one of us, the parliamentary career was actually could actually fit into the time that the research was going on. So all this fluidity meant to us that we had to focus on the big picture. But basically, really, we had no idea what the gender impact of the crisis was or was going to be. We had an open mind. And hence, we tried to focus on the evolving dynamics and have arrive at some kind of feeling of how things would be, and also how things would be in their contingent nature. That you know, we felt that you know things could move in particular directions, and it wasn't a certain thing which way they were going to be. So what our work is quite a thick little thing which has looks at an overview of statistical developments, and so derives 10 lessons, more or less stylized facts of what happened, and arrives at four risks that could affect what the final outcome would be. Now, the overall hypothesis is really quite clear. This, you know, will things go forward or back? There deep crises are associated with social change, and that there have already been comparisons, quite frequent comparisons with the U.S. Depression. And there are some people talking about the decline of the male breadwinner model, and women were hurt more. But at the same time, women tended to be much more invisible than men in the United States. But at the same time, while there was some movement towards traditional roles, the economic necessity actually pushed women to adopt much more active roles in work. In the 1980s, the recession, we all probably all know the film Full Monty. It had very, very definite gendered impact, and it was a gendered impact working in favor of women. And the early work on the European crisis also tended to show that women were doing less bad, badly than men. And gender gaps were shrinking. So, however, even though the received wisdom about crises is that they help women, the commentators are pretty apprehensive. And Joel Rubery, for example, said that the next years will bring not only severe hardship to women, but also potentially call into question some of the cornerstones of women's progress. I mean, that was the idea, the knife edge. So, setting the scene, what was the situation in before the crisis started?
Okay. So I'm not going to bombard you with lots of figures and graphs, but I would like to emphasize a little bit the progress that was made in Greece in the decades running up to the crisis. By focusing mainly on the world of work. Now, women's employment rate increased from below 40 to 52.5%. This is not something that is, you know, business as usual. It is a big progress. And, of course, I'm referring to women between 20 and 64 and not between 16 and 64, as it is the usual, because the prolongation of education is not considered to be a problem if women do not work at this stage. So we tend to look at ages starting from 20. The employment gender gap, which is the difference between women's employment rate and men's employment rate, really, declined substantially from 37% to 18%. And also unpaid family members who were one out of three working women in the early 80s declined to 9.5% of working women in year 2008. So there has been some clear progress. we're referring to a progress with asterisks in order to show that although only very, how shall I say, it would have been completely misjudged to say that the progress was not important, it is very crucial to look at some other aspects as well. Unemployment is one of them. Although employment has been growing up, unemployment has also been increasing among women. And in fact, the unemployment gender gap grew wider during these years. And interestingly, and less, this is less of a common knowledge, in terms of pensions gender gap, this is one of, among the largest in the EU, which means that older women are lagging more behind older men compared to other countries, whereas this 17% coverage gap means that 17% of women over 65 years of age do not have any pension scheme to lean on. Now, in terms of institutions, Platon alluded to it earlier, there has been a very busy legislative agenda concerning gender equality starting from the early 80s, really, but also a little bit before that, after the end of the dictatorship. So, in a sense, Greece tried to leapfrog in terms of legislation and cover the ground that has been covered in other European countries over a longer time period. But what is very important to bear in mind is that this progressive legislation was only enforced selectively. It was enforced primarily in the public sector, or in the visible part of the formal economy, but it could not and was not enforced in the wider economy. This means that there were two categories of people, and of this also refers to women, interestingly, the insiders and the outsiders. The insiders were very well protected. They enjoyed some privileges. They were the flagship of every government's agenda. They were saying we did this and that. And the outsiders, who silently had to deal with much more difficult situations. And the third asterisk or paradox is the question with the welfare state, because the thing is that if one looks at the expenditure of the Greek welfare state, it appears that starting from a low, quite low level in the 80s, it increased very substantially during the 90s and after year 2000. But the thing is that this increase in expenditure did not reflect an increase in services, in particular services that are considered to be feminine, like childcare, elderly care, services to working families, and this kind of stuff. So although there has been a very generous and impressive expansion of the welfare state, this did not cover. So these are basically, this is a graph to show how the employment rate, this is the red, increased up to the crisis. I'm not going to enter after that. The blue line is the gender gap, which has been declining also during the crisis. But the reason why I would like to show you this graph is the green one, because this shows the relative progress vis-a-vis European women. And there you can see that in the most interesting decades in terms of the Greek, in the progress of gender progress in Greece, the gap with the average European women's achievements or performance remained exactly the same. So we did not actually converge in the sense in terms of before the crisis at least, and during the crisis, the gap increased. So, this to show very briefly that in terms of attitudes and values, the progress in the labor market was not reflected in similar changes in mind frames. Greece is one of the countries where people think that men should have priorities in terms of when jobs are scarce, who should get a job. It is men who should. You see, it's one before last. And the second question, the second graph shows what if women should give up paid work for the sake of their family. And again, you can see that Greece is the third from the end, reflecting traditional values. Now, the main progress in women's employment was in the public sector. Of course, women increased their participation in the private sector as well, but the bulk of the new jobs for women were created in the public sector. And I would like to give you a very brief outline of the type of women that were attracted to the private and the public sector. For women with educational attainment up to secondary education, more than 3 out of 4 went to the private sector. In the private sector, they worked longer hours for fewer money. The 22.5% with secondary education who actually went to the public sector enjoyed 50% higher pay and 8% fewer hours compared to the others. Now, among women with tertiary education, half of them went to the private sector and half of them went to the public sector. Again, the public sector was much more generous to them. So this shows how women, although they start in the public sector, in the private sector, with or without children, they start with a handicap with a vis-à-vis men, because the 100 is men in the private sector in the index. You can see that regardless of whether they have children or not, their earnings tend to decline vis-à-vis men's as their career progresses. And I want to stress that because sometimes people think that it's just the fact that women have children that they have to take time off and then find it difficult to come back to the labor market. The thing is that because there is the assumption that women may have children at some stage, they get treated as if they had. They are not promoted. Anyway, I think you know whatever I'm saying. So, although I would like to say that insider women faced a completely different set of opportunities and constraints vis-à-vis outsider women, and I don't want to, overlook this, I would like to say that both insider and outsider women had some common characteristics, and these were the fact that they were working less than men, less hours, less days, less years. They were working for less, they were paid less throughout the work, and they tend to remain responsible for other very important activities in the house, what feminists call the other economic, and is basically care economy, the provision of care. So, am I done? So, Platon is going to talk a little bit about women and the... when we're trying to think what kind of hypothesis we would come up with in order to test them, we were trying to think positive for a change, because everybody during the crisis thinks in a very depressive sort of way. So we said, if institutional rigidities are swept away by the crisis, and these institutional rigidities tended to keep women in a lower place, then this could have potentially a positive influence. If employment is becoming more feminized in the sense that it's becoming less rigid and less continuous and less predetermined in its content and this kind of stuff, then women could, in principle, be in an advantageous position to deal with these employment changes vis-à-vis men. On the other hand, if the welfare state would start having substantial cuts, this could work against women. But if in Greece the welfare state is basically pensions and all the important stuff about care is done within the family, then this might not mean such a terrible thing for the balance of power between men and women. Anyway, what we're going to present to you from now on is an effort to keep an open mind when dealing with what we see in the statistics that we study. Because I think that it's not difficult to agree with me that when we start by saying that things are going in a very dangerous fashion from bad to worse, this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So let's try and keep an open mind and listen to Platon straight away.
Yeah. So this, when we set off on looking at what happened in the crisis, as the crisis itself was unfolding and the world was collapsing around our ears, and as we were working on gender, for instance, the interim report of this research project was submitted just as Greece was preparing to go for the referendum of July 2015. So, you know, we had to keep our wits about us. And we were very curious about what actually did happen, because we saw that there was a lot of people who had preconceived ideas or preconceived narratives who were really quite frequently not much to do with Greece. For example, Greece was was seen as the example of austerity politics, and hence what would happen in Greece would be fitted into some narrative about austerity, which fitted other narratives, but possibly not Greece, because as we saw, the underlying situation was in Greece was much more complex in that. And in any case, the Greek crisis was not an austerity crisis to begin with, at any rate, because austerity is hardly austerity when you're talking of a public sector deficit of 16%, which we had in 2009. If that is austerity, then everybody would like to have some. So what we did is we were fed by curiosity about what had happened, and as everyone knows, curiosity killed the cat. It didn't kill us, but I'm sure it killed the people who looked at this particular effort of 7 or 8 chapters, where we actually tried to keep an open mind and see what did the data tell us up until this time. So, I mean, this slide to just give you an idea of the chapters of the study. The labour market, we used the LFS data, so we had, there was a part looking at probability of employment and fitting a probit equation to this.
The theory refers to the chapter number, it's not a mistake, a typo mistake, that's right, from number three. Yeah.
And then this is an idea of the new work that we did. For in pay gaps, we did an Oaxaca type analysis of the determinants of pay in pre and post crisis. So what was the determinants of the pay gap in 2007, and what were the determinants of the gap using the same data in 2013. We looked at gender of retirement, but the pension gender gaps we've already seen, and also what is the transition from employment to retirement. So, and in fact, one of the things that was happening very in the group of insider women was a shift towards early retirement, which affected men, which affected women rather more than men. While we were actually doing about sort of three quarters of the way through our work, some new data on, well, the first ever data on time use in Greece was released by Elstat, so we leapt into the breach and produced a quick analysis on gender. And finally, there were the life cycle adjustments, things like the time of leaving parental home and the mother's age at first child had also been changed. So there's a lot of stuff there, and it's more than we are prepared to show, and I'm sure there's more than you can bear. So we'll just give you an idea of what was going and try to motivate the contingency of you know, the fact that, you know, we still, and we've looked at all this data and we still don't know. I mean, we still think that the jury is still out, even though certain things are quite well established. So one thing that is well established is that Greek women are what is known in the labor economics literature as added workers. So faced with the fact of far increased probability of being unemployed, what they do is that they actually enter the labor market in far larger numbers. Men, on the contrary, do the opposite. They're discouraged workers, so the people who, once they start trying to find a job, they are discouraged to give up and leave the labor market. Women, and certain kinds of women, for example, were foreign-born women, for instance, enter the labor force from inactivity. So there were previously women who had stayed at home. And what we see on the right-hand side is that the type of women who are more likely to exhibit this behavior are those whose spouse has had problems with his labor situation. So if the husband is unemployed, the woman is more likely to go out and work. So our hypothesis is that this is substituting for the lack of a safety net. And that is the reason why women in Northern Europe tend, as well as men, you know, tend to be discouraged workers. Whereas in Greece, the absence of a social safety net means that the family has to react in whatever ways it can. And one of those is to for the woman to go out and seek employment. And this is it. Also, if we look into the black box, what we see is that women are trying to work more, while at the same time they're not giving up their domestic burden, which is very considerable. So there's the right-hand side, which is the first ever time use study. It says it shows that in terms of what is known as core housework, Greek men on an average day are involved in core housework to the grand total of 27 minutes. women rather more. other European men are not much to write home about either. But even in the north, it's not great. But Greece actually stands out, and this is just a photograph because it's the first ever time use study. So we don't know whether that represents more or less than it was before the crisis. We do have some indications. If we look at household expenditure data, for example, we see that the sort of things which are complements to women's free time are falling. So catering services, routine household maintenance, all these things are falling, which means that somebody else is called to do the stuff that, that used to be outsourced before. So that gives you an idea of the conundrum that women are facing. They have to work more, they have to contribute more. At the same time, this is not recognized at home in the sense that they're not they don't appear to be being released for work. However, women's contribution to family finances increased faster during the crisis. So we see a family income being more dependent on women's work than it was before. So women are acquiring significance financially, which they didn't have before, and that this will be a key driver in their position in a sort of bargaining that would be going on inside the household. And the silver lining of a terrible policy is that pension gender gaps fell very dramatically, but that's not because women are having better pensions, is that because they have lower pensions, they were less liable to pension cuts, which were very widespread and affected the larger pensions. So from 39% gender gap in pensions, we're down now to 23%. So how do you put this whole picture together? And we were inspired by some talks with social anthropologists, and we decided to try and pretend to be sort of social anthropologists. So we give you three ideal typical Greek women, and we'll give you their stories, and we would like you to guess how these people would react to the sort of economic story that we were talking, because ultimately we think that the contingency and the contingent nature of what will turn up, the uncertainty, is going to depend on how individuals such as the ones that Andiwani will describe react and act in the coming months.
So. Okay, so I'm going to give you the stories of three women, one insider and two outsiders. The insider was born in the mid-50s, the one outsider in the mid-60s, and the other in the mid-70s. So we have a variety of ages. The insider is called Ariadne, and she was very happy during her life because she thought that she took all the right decisions while she was growing up. She entered university, she got her degree, she got a postgraduate diploma, she got a very good job in a bank, she got married to a high flyer in the banking sector. She has children, she made a career, she took an early retirement. She took advantage of all the privileges she could have while working or while growing up. Now, during the crisis, she suddenly realized that she was losing all her privileges. First, her early retirement translated into a very, very small monthly amount of money, which was not good enough for her to pursue her life. Having had a divorce at some stage earlier in her life, she realized that she could neither rely on her husband, who was no longer, nor to her parents, whose family business had collapsed, and they needed intensive care from her side. So she finds herself in a situation that during the crisis she becomes not only much poorer, but she needs to move back to her family house, and I'm stressing this because it's a real phenomenon happening to lots of people in Greece, in order to somehow cut down expenses, but also offer some support to her family. So in the end, as we speak now, Ariadne is very bitter because she thought she took all the right decisions. She really thought that she had made it, that she sort of broke free from the previous stereotype. And she realizes that whatever appeared to be an achievement or a privilege turned sour. So she's very negative. Yota is an outsider in the sense that she was born in Larissa from a small family of shop owners, a lower middle class family. She wanted to go to the university because she didn't know what else to do. She didn't want to work in the shop. She entered in her third attempt because the family was good enough to support all the promisteria. But as soon as she met her prospective husband, she dropped out of university. She returned to Larissa. Her parents opened her husband a frondistirio, which is a crammer's, basically, in order to, you know, have a... And the Yota herself got a job in a farmer's cooperative, which started very hopefully, but folded and went bankrupt some years later because it mismanaged European Union funds. Lots. This was an exception. Okay. So she lost her job, but she took the opportunity to have one child at that stage. Then she wanted to continue. She could not find another job. But then her husband told her, okay, I'm going to write you in the books of the frontistirio. You're not going to work, but I'm going to pay social security contributions so that you can retire early. So everything seemed to be all right. But during the crisis, things did not turn out very well. The frontistirio was doing badly. Parents had problems. She could not retire in her 50th birthday as she was expecting in year 2015 because by that time there has been a pensions reform and she had to work for another 17 years, so it didn't make any sense to appear on the books of the frontistirio, which was doing very badly anyway. So magically her brother-in-law became a Syriza MP, because this is how things develop in Greece magically recently, and he managed to hire her in a public enterprise called KTIP,
it
was in the newspapers the day before yesterday. It's an enterprise that creates buildings. It doesn't create any buildings over the past years, but still it's got 300 people and it's it's expanding to another 200 people. So she got her KTIP job, of course as a temporary worker, but she hopes to become a permanent worker, and because things do not look very promising for Syriza, she's trying to find a connection with New Democracy now. Her children's schoolmates, I don't know, some local people. So she hopes that she can navigate the crisis. But her approach is to play by the rules that will lead to an insider situation with all the old style. Okay, so let's move to the youngest and most hopeful outsider, Vivi, who is a hairdresser. So she went contrary to what was the correct recipe to do something that boys do. She did something that girls do. She didn't go to tertiary education. She went to a very short course in hairdressing. She went to work as a badly paid assistant in some salons in Kolonaki. But very soon she opened her own shop in a lower middle class area in Pankrati, in Northern Pankrati. She's doing very well. She's working hard hours, long hours. She's she's always investing in new techniques, new materials, high quality, but low prices. She employs five people over the past 10 years, which means during the crisis and before that. They work as a team. It is a very interesting horizontal new management idea. And now, as we speak, she's expanding her premise because there are lots of empty shops around. So she decided to go into double the space, actually. And she got a small loan from her parents in Dusso, who live in a mountainous village. She's very hopeful that she can manage to not only to survive but also to do well, regardless of when the crisis ends. So this is the story. You have to go fast with this risk assessment because
those are the 10 take-home lessons that our statistical analysis was able to pinpoint. Some of them I've already mentioned is that women's progress in employment was arrested by the crisis. Unemployment increased sharply for both men and women, but unfortunately public discussion talks as if only men's unemployment has increased. And very frequently we know unemployment is more serious now because it finally hits the male breadwinners. And they have been making a modest improvement in labour market performance. And however, poverty has concentrated on the working age population, has shifted away from pensioners and the elderly. But the poverty, it is much more closely associated with people with families. And they tend to be added workers. Unpaid women's work probably rose. An early retirement grew, especially among women. That has major long-term implications because it's storing up a problem for poor old women in decades to come. Now, this, what happens next? We really don't know. The crisis is still going on, and no one knows how or when it's going to end or what will happen next. There are various scenarios that are being... that's one problem. The second problem, obviously, is that the data is lagging behind developments, so we have to make do with survey data. Administrative data has more or less dried up. It's communicated to the Troika and occasionally leaked to the press, but it has ceased to be published. So you get trickles of data from here and there, and you very frequently don't know what to make of it. So that means that Greece was always in the forefront and in the forefront of post-truth politics in this particular case. So attitudes are shaped by perceptions and discussion, even if those are at variance with the facts, whatever the facts might mean. One key fact that is being talked about, for instance, I already mentioned, was the fact that unemployment now is more serious because it's affecting the breadwinners rather than simply women and young people as before. This is how we introduce the three ideal typical women. They'll probably see the crisis, their role in it, and each woman might see it in different ways because she hears different things and has different personal impressions. And her opinion will ultimately be the thing that will actually count about how things will turn up at the end. So, nevertheless, developments will be shaped by economics and policy choices. And in particular, we single out four different policy areas, in each of which there could be both good and bad scenario, and all of which can be affected by policy. So this is the simple version of this table. You can see the complicated version there, but I just what I need to say is that there are four risk areas. The labour market reforms that could uncover the hidden asset of women's work. Hidden asset means that the country that is facing is the second
fastest
aging in Europe after Germany. Something which Yanis Brous and myself pointed out to our regret quite a few years ago. Now, for a country facing this sort of challenge, having women only working at 56% is an incredible waste. And someone will see it sooner or later, so that would be one positive sense. But on the other hand, return to traditional mind frames can actually push things back. You need to monitor this, and what is currently happening now, which is statistical gender blindness, is the last thing you want to do, because you need to be aware of how things are going. And it can be affected by active labour market policies and other policies. So let's give you an idea of the sort of tension would be. Similarly, one can think of a different scenario according to how we exit the crisis. Is it going to be a public sector or large firm led recovery, or is it going to be a small enterprise recovery, which was the case in previous modes? The care nexus that refers to the need and how care for both for child minding and long-term care is organized. At the moment, I was actually shocked to find out that the flagship program for long-term care, the thing that people are always talking about, this is our response to long-term care, only spends 60 million drachma, 60 million euros in the whole country. It's not as bad as 60 million drachma, but it's not much better. And if you consider, for a population of 11 million, this is peanuts. And for a population which is aging, it's shocking. But there you are. And then finally, the welfare state. A welfare state which is very heavy on pensions and as a result offers hardly any services to help women, for example, to balance their responsibilities at home. And each of all these four risk areas carries a positive scenario, negative scenario, bottlenecks, counterweights. For example, the obvious reforms that are taking place in welfare state, such as to introduce a social safety net, which is after 7 years is actually being introduced in 2017. But that was introduced as a result of the Troika placing pressure on the Greek government, which was not only this Greek government, all previous Greek governments were resisting the pressure to institute a social safety net. But when we say social safety net, we just mean guaranteed minimum income. Policies associated with the Troika are very easily they can be vilified very easily and hence either not implemented half-heartedly or reversed later on. So, what would our three women say about the four risk areas?
Okay, in order to imagine what things will look in the future, we have to somehow know how Ariadne, Yota, and Vivi will respond to what are the lessons that they have learned. I'm not sure that Ariadne has learned her lesson that privileges and principles of her time are no more available, and she needs to do something else. I'm not sure that Yota, the wannabe insider, is willing to play by new rules because she thinks that she can still navigate the situation. The only optimistic outlook comes from Vivi, who is a small entrepreneur, who knows what she's doing, but we don't know if her dynamism will be enough to lift the other women out of poverty and out of their false consciousness. So the other problem, the Marxists suddenly woke up late in the evening. But also there's another factor that we don't know. What will happen with Brunhilde, who is who is supplying finance for this whole story. Will she lose her patience and pull the plug? Or will she continue? So in order to see what, to give you a picture of what's happening, here on the left-hand side you have Ariadne, Jota and Vivi contemplating the next moves, whereas here is Brunhilde, who is really wondering what she should do concerning her financial line to Greece. Okay. So,
so this is
thank you very much.
Don't ask us, ask us, ask them.
Okay, there's a lot in that presentation, sorry, including Ariadne, Jota and Vivi, who I think are probably going to generate the most questions from this audience. But please feel free to ask about any aspect of the presentation and the work that Andigone and Platon have done. Could you please just introduce yourself for everybody's benefit before you ask a question?
Sorry. My name is George Hetzi. I'm a pensioner, former Greek civil servant. Is Vivi using ladies from Lysa or ladies born in other countries, especially ladies from the north?
Is Vivi using?
And what is the... immigration.
Okay, okay, Vivi, yes, sorry. I got mixed up with my women. Who is working for her, yeah.
And are all Vivis of Greece ladies born in Greece?
No.
Or would you like to take them one question at a time? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the Vivi, who happens to be a real person, four out of five people working for her are Greek-born Greek nationals. That's one nice. Man, three women. The fifth person is a Georgian who's got married to a Greek man, so she's got all the... And she has been living in Greece for the past 20 years. So this is not a firm that thrives on cheap labor.
But the point is well taken, because one of the areas of indeterminacy, contingency, is that what you talked about last week. So it's the tendency of people leaving the country, and which has also political implications, because it means that there's the old Hirschman model of exit, voice and loyalty. This sort of exit really goes with signing off from attempting to affect matters from within. One of the, well, there's the brain drain of Greeks leaving Greece, and unfortunately there is an equivalent drain of immigrants and their offspring of the 90s who are returning back to their ancestral homes. Some of them might come back, but at the moment there is another sort of dangerous sign ahead.
Rebecca Bryan from the Conservatory. Thank you very much for that. I just wanted to ask, this is going to be a big question and maybe difficult for you to answer, but I wonder if you could say a little bit about how gender is intersecting with generation and the age cycle, and especially if you have any data on things like how the crisis is affecting age of marriage, reproduction.
Yes, we do.
Or and also apart from that, those sort of hard facts issues, how it's also affecting perceptions of, for example, stages in the aging cycle, like when you have to go live at home again, how is that affecting people's perceptions?
We do have actually a section on leaving the parental home, and what is happening is that this is happening later, but there's also a difference between urban and rural. and between men and women. Generally, the sort of differences you find in perceptions and values are much lower at young ages, but we're not really sure. And one of the things that could be very useful to investigate is whether this is an age effect or whether it's a function effect. So would traditional values return when motherhood comes in, for example? And because one of the things, well, the Greek welfare state relies on the great institution of the Greek grandmother. And one of the things that we actually see, today's children are seeing, is that Greek grandmothers nowadays are much less willing to sacrifice themselves than their own parents were. I mean, I tell my students there is the bottle of the grandmother of the Pindos, of the heroic grandmother who's rushed off to the mountains for the fatherland, and as opposed to the grandmothers of the polytechnic generation, who are looking after number one.
But it also must be the case that if they're taking early retirement but then forced to go back to work, it's harder for them to look after their grandchildren. Right? If you have women who take early retirement at 50 but then have to go back and work until they're 67,
The ones who are retired are, at the moment, they're well out of the cessation of early retirement worked on the everyone who had managed to retire early by August 2015 was able to do so, and it affected people from this point on. So we don't actually know what would happen, and the interesting thing is that in Greece, retirement is not seen as anything that actually depends on what happens on the demand for labour side. So I mean, on the willingness, on the whether there will be jobs for those people. So there will be an increasing problem of women, 50-year-old women trapped in the labour market, for whom who find it very hard to find a job. This is an example of the kinds of things and of the way that reforms actually impinge on what the kind of things that people would have taken for given in Greece for a very long time. And so the very simple thing of saying, well, things will carry on as before, will not be able to do so, because one example is that women will not be able to drop out of the labour force at 50, they have to work in 67, or be unemployed in 67, because these, for example, pay scales haven't adapted. So if women were to stay on at work, then their, especially in the public sector, their wage rates will rise. So that's going to affect the employers' willingness to give them jobs.
And there was another element to the question which had to do with marriage and childbirth.
Yeah, well,
in the case of UV, for example. Are there any patterns emerging?
Well, older women who have women in their mid-30s who had postponed... older. Who had postponed their first child at the beginning of the crisis are now realizing that they'd better do something quick, so that there is an increase in childbearing for women around 35, while at the same time there is a decrease of first births for women in their 20s.
Let me just add one word concerning attitudes and values. It is always a puzzle. It's always puzzling to me the fact that among my students, female students tend to think that feminism, for instance, or the discussion about principles of equality is something very old style, very passé, and very incompatible with new lifestyles. At the same time, these people are queuing endless queues to go to the proskynima, how shall I say this, of the Giazzoni, the pilgrimage of some obscure sacred
saints
anyway, and they don't think that this is passé. Greece somehow passed from the pre-feminist to the post-feminist era without intermediate stop in feminist discussion. So I'm not ready to answer this question, but what I can tell you is that equality and feminist principles are not considered to be something worth discussing or fighting for some strange reason.
Thank you. It's Tamura Dubiru, University of St. Andrews. What you call progress, I'm not sure that I agree with the term, but this is what you call it. It covers a period where gender realization came a lot with patronage and women being recognized as considerable political force. So you had to add this element of patronage in your data, if it is possible to do so. But at the same time, you have to realize and you have to recognize that gender and its realization became and was still very firm within kinship systems in Greece. And I wouldn't be surprised, like you, as you said, that feminism still goes hand in hand, or ideas about feminism have not changed. If you think of the work of Dubis and other anthropologists of Greece, particularly. But I'd like you to say a bit more about these two elements of patronage in these three, 30-year span, where you call it progress, and how patronage and at the same time the realization of gender through kinship affected your day.
Okay, this is a huge question, very, very important. I'm not sure I'll give you a very satisfactory answer, but my first reaction to this would be the following. Progress among economists is very closely linked to economic independence. To me, to my mind, women working for a wage or women working for an income, an independent income, mark a progress vis-à-vis their mothers who did not, or grandmothers, because I think, or at least to my mind, but I admit to being an economist, so I can't go completely above my discipline, that you have different kinds of options and degrees of freedom if you have an independent income. So this is why I'm driving all my social scientists, non-economist friends crazy wherever I speak about progress. To me, working women have more independence and greater freedom to choose how they're going to live their lives. And I can see that. It's a naked eye evidence around me that people with independent income have more choices. Now, concerning patronage and clientelistic politics, it's clear that women were seen as a political force, but a political force to be pampered and at the same time being restricted in specific roles. So it was offered, it was sold as a privilege to women that they were allowed to take early retirement. The fact that early retirement blocked their whole career, because you are not going to invest in somebody who is going to take early retirement if you are managing the human resources of your company. The fact that that they were going to live for decades on a low pension, because early retirement does not offer good pensions. Nevertheless, this was seen to be a bonus for women. To my mind, this was not a bonus. It was a trap. And I find it very dispiriting that 9 out of 10 feminists in Greece are fighting for early retirement. They're thinking that this should be something that should be, defended.
But this reflected on your paper,
though. What?
This tendency.
Of what?
Of women being pampered, of women being thought as less. Therefore, what is progress is not actually progress. It's something which you need to find another terminology.
Okay, but compared to the counterfactual, I'm not sure this is not a better situation. But again, this is a question of judgment. It is a question of judgment. I don't buy easily the story of my grandmother that because she had five children, because she had six sisters, and because she was deciding whatever she thought was important, like how much salt to put in arnaki, that she was the queen of the family and on top of the world. I don't buy it. I think maybe she had to believe it in order to survive and not, you know, jump from a high rock to the deep sea. But I think that at this stage that I am is progress vis-à-vis Yaya Stavroula situation.
If I may interject, that progress in
it's my real Yaya name, Yaya Stavroula.
Progress was in this area probably more than others was measured in a legalistic way in terms of what was the legal norms had been legislated, and so progress went along with a lot of rhetoric. And I would probably say verbiage, and very little social science in the sense of actually tracking what real women were doing. So the first generation feminists who were associated in political terms in the first government of Pasok in the 80s, partly because of the influence of the prime minister's wife and so on, they were very vocal and very active in passing legislation, but they didn't seem to worry so much about what was happening in how this legislation was implemented. And in some cases, they actually made by legislating things which were virtually impossible to monitor or even to enforce in the small family enterprises which were characteristic of Greece. They could have actually made the life of the outsider women, for example, harder. So there was, in Greece, and that's very hard for Greek feminists, I think, feminist politicians, I think, to accept, that there is that the world of women contains a different experience for insider women and outsider women. And the dominant discourse is very much, comes from the direction of insider women.
Could I just ask a very brief brief question? Obviously, the data that you've shown us shows that the crisis has had a tremendous impact on women and gender gaps and pay gaps and the rest of it. You're referring to a debate about feminism and a formalistic, legalistic process that took place in the early 80s. What's the level of debate in Greece today about the role of women in society? Is there a debate about these kinds of figures? Is there a sort of a movement amongst women for a sort of neo-feminist debate in Greece? Are we still lodged in this, in the sort of 80s, 80s background? Has the crisis given rise to a debate?
The short answer is no.
No. I didn't think so. I just wanted to confirm that, that's all.
But in Parliament, too.
I'm not going to start telling you stories about
well,
the level
story
of the discussion of feminist issues in the Greek Parliament. You don't want to hear
one story.
About it.
Come on.
Something with you?
One story.
No.
No. Okay. Gotcha. I have to buy you a strong drink afterwards to get this.
Dathan, I have a question for you. Why did governments across the board never support a social assistance, a basic social safety net? And for you, Antigone, did you look into how Ariadne's and Vivi's political engagement changed? Did they change, for example, for whom they voted? Are they all Syriza and are disappointed Syriza, or does the political engagement very much reflect how it fares through these times?
Okay, you go first.
The reasons the government, successive government, gave is that the administrative preconditions for implementing this law were not there. In the sense there would be too much leakage because of tax evasion and tax declarations not being truthful, there would be too much leakage. Now, of course, this at any one point in time is would hold, but if you actually integrate a period of 30 years' time, so the fact that they never did anything about that is the interesting point. So even if at point X you didn't do it, the fact that you never took any measures to be able to implement it. There was actually there was one case of a social safety net implemented for pensioners, because pensioners' tax data is more reliable than others, and this was the pension supplement called ECAS. But even during the bailout, it was very interesting because it was in the first bailout had specified a requirement of the Greek government to come up with a proposal for social safety net by September 2010. That requirement was completely ignored by the Labour minister, who was trying to show that she was trying to parade her left-wing credentials. So it was interesting, it was the left-wing that did not support the social safety net, and Syriza in its own time, actually, Syriza was interesting because while they were a party of 4% in opposition, it was part of the party's platform to implement a social safety net. When they rose above the 15% threshold, became the official opposition, they dropped that. So in 2015, we were back in the same sort of tug of war with the Troika saying you have to have a social safety net, and the Greek government saying, you know, we're fine, we don't want it. The reason they prefer it, my reading is that they, Greek, not just Syriza, everyone, Greek political parties would rather have categorical interventions that address particular groups of the population, because with those groups you can negotiate and you can you can come to political deals, because the Greek politics is in a very macho phase where at the moment it says, you know, political will and political negotiation is what is the ideal.
Let me just add a little insight from this. I was speaker for Potami in the discussion about minimum guaranteed income, and
Potami supported that.
Yes, and I got this very interesting reaction from various speakers from the Syriza side, who more or less accused me for supporting the minimum guaranteed income as a person who is not interested in guaranteeing full employment, because what people want is not, you know, some small income to support them. They want full-time jobs with minimum wages that should be much higher than what they were. And in fact, the persons who are really progressive in their mind were those people who try to ensure magically full employment and good conditions of work. And if you started discussing about the most vulnerable, they are accusing you for trying to redistribute poverty. This is the cliche. You're not interested about, you know, poor, you're just wanting to redistribute poverty. So, I mean, I'm not very optimistic that this is going to be more perceived in a better way. Now, concerning the political affiliations of these women, the only pro-European one, although the Maya Ariadne, the insider, was very sophisticated politically and pro-European, of course, because she also had a master's degree and she spoke languages and she traveled and stuff. she voted no in the referendum, and she's completely pissed off. She's in the completely negative phase. My wannabe insider outsider, Jota, was never very interested in politics, but she sees politics as the way to secure important advantages at various points. So she doesn't mind, as her parents moved from PASOK to Syriza, she doesn't mind herself moving from Syriza to Nea Dimokratia, provided that she can get a better deal. The only very enthusiastic pro-European, for reasons that I'm not certain exactly why, is the young hairdresser.
It who hasn't thinks... changed. It hasn't changed her political
views. No, no. She, in a bizarre way, she thinks that there are still opportunities in Greece during the crisis. She found them, at least.
So I want to ask about the fourth woman who was born in the 90s,
okay.
Eleni, who had the good fortune to grow up in the age of the lobster pasta. However, in a very poor village in Helsinki, her parents were absolutely not able to afford lobster pasta, but at least they could afford to send her to Prodisterio. So she went to university. She applied to university before the crisis began. She studied to be a teacher because it was a guaranteed job. She thought it would be a guaranteed job. Well, in the middle of her studies, the crisis had hit. It had become apparent she would actually take many years until she could actually become work as a teacher. She wasn't very motivated. She gave up. She got a part-time job at Benetton. She had to work an internship where she wasn't paid for a month or two. And then her part-time contract stated she had to work, you know, half the time. So she still kind of hoped to do university on the side. But actually, the company asked her to work full-time, even though she got only paid for half-time. And she would get the extra money at the end of the year. So she's very, very dispirited, actually. She belongs to that generation that voted overwhelmingly no. I guess the question is, how can you unleash that creative potential to make her a bit more like Jota, instead of, you know,
We have to work on this character. I mean, give me your email address before you leave. Okay. Yeah. I'm not going to say anything because I want to think about it. Okay? Come on, Talia.
I'm Talia Majol, visiting fellow at the Hellenic Observatory. It's been very interesting because I think the side of employment is what is the other side of, well, there are many other sides of something that I'm doing on democracy and in Greek too. Well, I'm not working just with women, but thinking of what women have said, like before the crisis. What has struck me, and also from discussions we had, is that there was no plan for the 18 to 26, like at the late 90s and 2000, of some kind of a family to begin with. Because most people saw themselves as children, like not adults yet, with a project that sometime they would get a very nicely paid job, or and they could become adults in their 50s. That's the time that you would have all this essential independence from parents. And what I saw in more recent interviews, again, well, I found people who are divorced before their 30s, women also, but they didn't talk to me about families. They talked to me about other people who were obliged to have a family and somehow regretted it. I also saw that there are women who work and they tell me that their boyfriend is a long-term unemployed, something that you mentioned as discouraged
Discouraged.
Discouraged. My question after all this is, I see that women are working like those I talked to, but some of them in sort of precarious jobs, like they could have two jobs, and they might work more than some other members of the family. They could have an unemployed father, for example, still, when they stay in the house. Maybe this is a little bit more empowering than being just given some money while they wait for something better. Are these jobs today, apart from those who are like the example of Vivi, are they most like this, or maybe the young women working but in sort of this kind of jobs, distributing leaflets while studying a little bit, while painting nails, half-time, other people trying to become an electrician, like female, very dynamic, and at night working as a cashier at the sort of Spinatico, the
not dog house, however.
It doesn't translate.
I mean, are there a lot of these, or are there, yes, young women who are trying to do their best, but who are trying to have these two, three jobs that don't really bring a pension maybe in the future?
Okay, I happen to be one of those people who believe that bad jobs are useful, and it's useful for people to have experience in bad jobs. What, however, is important is not to somehow imprison people in bad jobs throughout their lives. So the idea of somebody who is studying but also working in Benetton and works a little bit in the Skiladiko, selling gardenias for the remaining few rich people, is not, to me, is not something to be anxious about. On the contrary, what I find very problematic is the fact that I meet young people who say, there is no point in going to get a job for €650 per month. There is no point in going to get a job if I have to work 1 or 2 hours overtime without being paid. It's not worth having a job if the top CEO gets 100 times my salary. It's not worth the effort. Now, this I find worrying. This I find really worrying.
And certain things that Greeks understand as the pathology of the Greek economy, for example, the prevalence of young people working on as self-employed, the blokakia, sort of, are actually examples of a much more general trend, which is characterizing the world economy as a whole. So what is known as the gig economy. Gig in the sense of gigs in music concerts, or sometimes known as the Hollywood models, the idea that where you see this at the top end of the market, when, for instance, there's a group of people come together to make a Hollywood film. They would work together for a while as self-employed people, that they would coalesce, and then they would do whatever their particular job, and then they would each go their separate ways. Now you see this at the very top end of the market, or you see it at the bottom end of the market. And I think the world as a whole is in complete, really doesn't know how to react to this, and what kind of social protection they would offer these people who are working. Obviously, you don't have to give too much social protection if you're a Hollywood director, but if you are a little, you do male nails in your spare time and work as in an accounting office for that, you do deserve that. And one of the dangers is that it's actually seen, this in Greece at any rate, it was seen as a way of tax evasion. So what we've seen at the moment is, we're living through in Greece is an attempt at over-regulation of this activity in the field of social insurance. So they're treating all the self-employed, including the ones who are just using, they're just starting a second job in order to supplement their income. they're treating them as if they were proper wage employees and charging them the same social insurance contribution rates, which means that, for example, someone who's which you are liable to pay up to 38.5%, usually 28.5%, starting from the very first euro you earn. This is prohibitive, and it's this by treating what is essentially was the Uber economy, by treating it as if it was part of just simply a tax evasion mechanism, you will actually hurt both the people doing it and the prospects of competitiveness of the country. And this is part of the problem that comes from not talking about things openly. I'm pretty sure that when this thing started 20 years ago, it was just a tax evasion device, but it isn't anymore.
Let's take one last question, and then we have to finish that.
Charles Sue from UCL, and apology. I just had a really, it's just an observation, and you might want to comment on it, but I couldn't help but notice and also see in the conversation we're having, reinforced that VV, her job is providing services to females, many of whom are probably employed, and doing all this, absorbing work in the economy in the various ways that they do part-time, however they're employed. And I guess that was one of, that's the interesting point in this talk, really, is it was perception and the reality of women's employment. I think what you were saying is that they are maybe a little bit more employed, but it's the perception is they're a lot more employed. Was that part of your point, or did I miss? Anyway, they're employed. They're certainly employed. They continue to be employed. And maybe in this crisis, there's something to think about here, is the growing economy of services for women, engaged by women who are employed. And so I wondered about that more generally, and we've talked about painting nails as well just now. In the crisis, how, is there any observations about the kind of beauty industries from the lowliest nail bar to cosmetic surgeries and things like that, and women's employment in that sector, and women's employment by directly or indirectly by women.
Vivi is a career woman, so she defines herself in terms of her job. Whereas Jota, etc., is someone who is a occasional worker and sees her role as a constituent part of a family economic unit. So she works whenever her husband can't, and whenever her parents and so on could. Now, also the gig economy is the things that cannot be outsourced. Our services and personal services, nails and so on, are exactly the same thing. So, and the fact, well, it was Antigone who dreamed up the three women, but I think it's not coincidental that it's a woman's service sector.
I would like to point out that salons cater for men also. I mean, it's not okay, because sometimes we tend to forget it. Secondly, I can't get used to the idea that certain occupations like hairdressers, nails, are considered to be inferior, whereas a plumber is superior, or a bad teacher is more prestigious than the person who is doing the perfect massage. Now, in our time, all the activities linked to some definition of the self, like gyms, hairdressers, personal training, yoga teaching, whatever, have increased regardless of the crisis. Gyms are not used as in a pejorative way, because lots of men go there and they become, stronger. Whereas hairdressers are always used by economists or my colleagues in order to show what a ridiculous turn the economy is taking. I mean, like, you know, only hairdressers are opening shops. I think that we need to rethink about the usefulness of certain occupations and tasks. And I think that there is a lot of future in this kind of service provision. And those who invest cleverly on this will do very well, as the experience shows.
But how many can they be?
You never know how many they can be, because
Well, for example, it's an export sector, because nowadays, I mean, we see that people are part of the tourist market.
Anyway. So what's the difference? More people, more women go more often to fix their hair.
You know, in 1990, okay, in 1990, Greece had an unemployment rate of 12 to 13%, I think. If anybody told us that the Greek economy would absorb 1 million immigrants from Albania and Eastern Europe, and unemployment would not increase at all.
No, it would actually fall.
It would actually fall. We would say that this person needs immediate emergent care. I mean, you know, call the ambulance and stuff. This is what happened. Because in reality, you can never know exactly at what price, what kind of services, or what kind of demand will be. And this is the interesting thing about the economy. And this is the
many men become hairdressers.
Of course.
Yeah.
There's an increase.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think this is a problem.
But the interesting thing about the developments
in
the
professions, there's competition between foreigners, immigrants, and locals.
I think that in recent years, hairdressing has stopped being a traditional female job. So
in this low level.
It's not low-level. I mean, I know so many, you know.
Cleaners, for example.
Can I just, we have run over time, and it's an interesting discussion, but perhaps one we can continue on another occasion. Before we thank our speakers for a really fascinating presentation, I'd like to wish you all a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, and remind you that the next occasion we're meeting is on the 17th of January, and I'll spare you the details right now. But in the meantime, please join me in thanking Antigone and Platon for a really fascinating talk.
Thank you very much.